Risky business. Risky business. Risky business.
Hiya, this is Risky Business and I'm Patrick Gray. This week's netcast is brought to you by Sophos and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting. This week we're taking a look at the bad habits of Oracle administrators. The company has just released a survey report with some downright shocking numbers in it. Perhaps the most startling figure in this survey of DBAs is that 11% of Oracle administrators have never applied a critical security patch to the systems they maintain, which of course made me think of this line from Harold and Kumar, Escape from Guantanamo Bay.
What the fuck? What the fuck? What are you doing?
Well, I guess that makes my feelings clear. Now, only 30% of respondents actually apply Oracle critical patch updates within the first 3 months of their release. Securus Global's Declan Ingram will be along soon to have a chat about these numbers and what they mean and how they came to be. We'll also check in with Simon Howard, who's probably best known as the organiser of the Race to Zero contest in Las Vegas. He's had a bit of experience working with DBAs and says the patch problem is nothing compared to the host security issues you get when you're working with big databases. In this week's sponsor interview, Paul Ducklin from Sophos pops in for his regular spot. And this week we're having a chat about all that zero day everywhere. PDFs, XLS, etc, etc. Now, it wasn't possible to raise Munir this week, Munir Katadia, our regular news guest. Last I heard, he's still having a blast in Mumbai. But that's okay, because our good friend Adam Boileau joins us on the line from New Zealand to fill in. And Adam, we're going to turn our attention now towards the Conficker worm, and more particularly the reporting about the Conficker worm. We've seen a story headlined, Conficker worm targets Southwest Airlines site, on cnetnews.com, but this story is a little bit bogus. Have you got the skinny on this one?
Oh, well, this is such a complete crock, man. Talk about bad reporting. So the Conficker worm uses effectively randomly generated DNS names. So eventually we're going to stumble across one that actually means something. In this case, it's what, like a Southwest Airlines site, wnsucks.com?
No, it's actually a redirect to the main southwest.com
Southwest.com. And it just so happens that Conficker has picked this particular DNS name, and now we're making a song and dance out of it.
Yeah, it seems a little bit
Yeah, exactly. That's a good summary noise.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, no, I just thought we should point that one out because a few people might have thought that the great big DDoSing was about to begin, but no, that is not the meaning of that story, so hope that clears that up. And Adam, there's been another rogue application on Facebook, which makes it something like four in the past week. This is probably going to turn into a bit of a problem for the actual company, you'd think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know quite what they're going to do about it, really. I mean, the Facebook's popularity is such that people are going to find ways to attack it. There's so much useful data to mine there, and so many suckers doing their Web 2.0 thing.
Yeah. And there's that whole trust thing, which, I guess in the original idea, it's supposed to make you more secure because you're accepting content from people you trust. But, of course, as soon as someone can infiltrate that trust network, whether that's through social engineering or through some sort of malware attack, it turns out to be pretty soft once you get in there.
Yeah, and you put all that social relationship information in there, and all it does is give attackers ways to exploit it and reasons to exploit it. I mean, if anything, I think it probably lowers the security posture of your trust network by having it mapped out so clearly.
Mm-hmm. Now, in this report written by CNetNews.com, it says the popular social networking site has been hit by what's believed to be the fourth rogue app in a week and is investigating the spread of a new variant of the Kubeface worm. Kubeface worm spreads via a message from a Facebook friend that includes a link to what looks like a video. You install a bad codec and the rest is history. Now, look, in this next piece, it looks like some researchers managed to actually copy the blueprints for Marine One, which is the President of the United States' helicopter. It's managed to actually just grab them over peer-to-peer.
Oh, dear, yeah. But it's interesting how many data leaks actually come out of rogue peer-to-peer software lying around the place. We've seen it in banks. We've seen it, in Asia, or some of the strange Asian peer-to-peer applications leaking data. So, yeah, seeing this, super secret, well, maybe not super secret, but, you know, somewhat sensitive blueprints for the helicopter heading off to, not an Iranian IP address, according to the, you know.
And it always sounds sinister. It always sounds sinister when it's an Iranian ISP. It's probably just some teenager, you know what I mean, who's got a thing for helicopters.
Well, it may, you know, peer-to-peer network, who knows if the traffic's even actually going there, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And especially when it's being reported by a company that makes products that monitor sharing of files online, they'll find whatever they want to do to get the headline, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, good one. I like how it's being touted as some major breach of US security that's putting the president at risk. And really, I think all you could really do with this information is perhaps build your own helicopter.
A stunt double. That's exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they could sell it to Hollywood. All right. Now, this is really funny, actually. Sting, the front man behind one of my favorite bands, The Police, who totally, like, just are awesome. I know you're into metal, so you probably don't appreciate that. Sting has come out in support of the so-called NASA hacker, Gary McKinnon.
So I think the funny thing about this story is that it gets the award for bitchiest reporting in the security industry for the year.
Kevin
Paulson really
go on,
lays
I'm sorry.
Into the guy.
Yeah, Kevin Paulson, who we should point out actually did 5 years of his own in prison in the United States for hacking-related offences. And I guess maybe Kevin's feeling a bit insecure because no superstars came to his defence when he was up on charges.
Damn, Michael Jackson should have done it.
Yeah, so this is a story that appeared on Wired's 27B/6 blog, and it is a pretty funny read, I've got to admit. And I do know Kevin, and he's got a very dry wit, which just certainly comes through in this piece.
I think the best bit, it says, the U.S. response in relation to the true nature of Gary's crime is disproportionate in the extreme, Sting said, referring to the extremely disproportionate response of charging a 43-year-old man with computer intrusion when all he did was intrude into some computer.
Zing. Now, what I think is funny about this one is that I think a lot of the Yanks are missing the point. The point isn't that he shouldn't be charged. It's the point that extradition treaties do not exist for this purpose. If I break the law from Australia, I go hack into a bunch of American computers. Guess where I committed the crime? In Australia. We also have laws within Australian borders that can prosecute me. Me breaking into an American computer from Australia or from the UK is a crime in both of those countries. Now, extradition treaties exist when you can't charge someone. It doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense that they are going to allow this extradition. It was like that guy, Hugh Griffiths, who was a software pirate who was extradited from Australia to America to face charges there and spent considerable time in prison over there, where here he would have most likely gotten off with a wholly suspended non-custodial sentence. So, you know, that's why if there are any Americans listening and they want to know why people are upset about this, that's why.
Yeah, and I suppose banding around the terrorism word pushes everyone's buttons. Banding around the terrorism word does kind of push everyone's buttons these days.
Yeah, yeah, but apparently, I mean, according to Kevin Paulson's report here, there is no terrorism charge about to be laid against McKinnon's, against McKinnon. But and he already turned down apparently an offer to basically plead and do 18 months in the United States. So now he faces 6 months to 6.5 years. So he's not probably going to get locked away for decades as, I've even been guilty of parroting that alleged fact, which has, of course, turned out to be a bit bogus. But let's just see what happens. My personal opinion, he shouldn't be extradited.
Well, that's what Sting thinks, so it must be right.
Of course, man. I mean, he wrote Roxanne, so he can't be wrong. This next piece I find really funny because it's such a non-event. People may have seen it doing the rounds, and it popped up under Full Disclosure and, of course, wound up being reported on by darkreading.com. There is apparently a Gmail flaw that allows an attacker to control a change password function. Now, what I find funny about this is you actually need to know the password in order to change it.
Yes, I'm not sure. I haven't looked into the specific details of this vulnerability yet, so I can't say for sure that that is the case, but it seems surely it would be madness to suggest that this was a vulnerability if you actually needed to know the password to do it.
Yeah, look, I think someone's actually having a bit of fun, and I think they're probably quite delighted that it's received some coverage because the whole thing is just so utterly ridiculous. It's like you can do a special post, you know, but you need the original password thing. I mean, it's sort of being sold as a way to silently try to brute force someone's account, but I mean, wouldn't you just like attack the login form?
Yeah, there must be some detail here that we are missing, because it just seems crackheaded otherwise.
I think it might,
of course,
in fact,
it could
be,
just be crackheaded.
Well, yeah, I think it might in fact be crackheaded. I think they might be on the pipe.
On the pipe, and they should lay off it.
They should lay off the pipe, or at least lay on something better. I don't know. Okay, Adam, that takes us to the end of the news, mate. Thanks again for popping in.
Thanks very much, Pat.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with a look at this week's news headlines. Now it's time for a bit of housekeeping, and we've got some AISA events coming up. That's the Australian Information Security Association. The 18th of March, there is a Sydney presentation. Also on March 18th in Brisbane, in Canberra, March 20. More information at www.aisa.org.au. Now it's time for this week's feature, and we're going to have a chat first up with Declan Ingram about this amazing report Oracle put out. It was Oracle in conjunction with the Independent Oracle Users Group, or IOUGBLA, that did this study, and it basically found the people responsible for patching Oracle boxes seldom do. Declan joins me now, and mate, what do you make of all of this? Do you think the DBAs, a few too many of them, got dropped on their head when they were kids?
Well, I don't actually think it's the Oracle DBAs themselves. I think that their primary focus is looking after their organization's data, and that usually comes down to the contents rather than actually administering the, you know, patching the systems and everything else. One of the things that I've certainly found consistently is this beautiful irony that organizations won't patch critical infrastructure because they're too important to disrupt. In most instances, that just makes absolutely no sense. But coming down to the liability of the individual administrator and the if it's not broken, don't fix it. I mean, that is something that, as ridiculous as it sounds, is something that's still very much in use today. The reason Microsoft patching is so common now is not only because it's easy, because Microsoft has sort of pulled their finger out and created a framework that actually works, but because there was a problem. You know, it was broken, so people did have to fix it. Whereas I don't think that has been demonstrated well enough with a lot of the top-end enterprise gear around Oracle and lots of other things.
The thing that I really don't get about this, Declan, right, is that this is enterprise software. Oracle is deployed usually in large companies. I mean, you know, small companies, SMEs, they don't run Oracle. It's too bloody expensive. So it's really hardcore, full-on, put it in a big 4RU rack-mountable box in a nice data center, you know, and have lots of people fussing all over it. So typically in an organization like that, you do have an InfoSec team. What is happening? Where are things going wrong such that the InfoSec team is letting this slide?
Basically, people are starting at the edges of their organization. People are starting at the perimeter and working in.
Isn't that a little bit daft?
In some ways it is, in some ways it isn't. I've had to have been one of those poor people that sat there night after night installing Solaris clusters, patch clusters that, you know, break everything and you end up having to, you know, in a worse state than you did at the beginning. So I understand why the admins cry.
So what you might be saying, what you might be suggesting here is that perhaps the difficulty in applying Oracle's patches to begin with could have some sort of impact on their propensity or likelihood of applying them.
Yes. Certainly, that's one of the reasons why the Microsoft patching is so common. It's because it's so simple. They've set up the stuff. It's easy to test. It's easy to deploy. You can roll back if required. Whereas, you know, a lot of the big end stuff, if you have any issues at all, often people don't have as complete a testing environment to go and do everything. Especially, you know, if you're running this database and it's the core of your business, you could have 100 different applications getting data from your database, and any changes that you make in anything associated with that could have all sorts of bizarre consequences. And so in terms of, you know, applying this risk, if you've got a known unknown in a potential vulnerability that may be out there and it's in a protected part of your network, and installing that could have all sorts of potential issues going back with all of your legacy applications and everything else, then what are you going to do? I mean, I'm not saying that people shouldn't patch stuff, but to a certain extent, I'm just sort of trying to understand, you know, where organizations are coming from in when they don't do this.
Were you surprised by the numbers that were in that survey report?
I wasn't, except I would probably go so far as to say that the figures in this report would probably favor organizations which know what they're doing. Because if someone is not on top of it, if you have an organisation that's really not on top of it, if you've got a DBA that is patching is not high on their list of things that they're going to be doing, I can't imagine them jumping on the internet and filling out a survey about their patching.
Yeah, okay, right. So I guess you're suggesting that it could actually be a little bit worse than the report suggests.
I guarantee that it's a little bit worse. And one of the interesting findings that came out of the report is that most respondents report that their organisations are either current with the critical patch update or one release late. Now, this is something that I've found really quite interesting. When you go into an organisation doing some form of audit or security review or anything, and you start off talking to some of the high-level execs that oversee the technical streams of the business, and they'll come out and they'll say, yes, we're very, very secure, we do this, that and the other and all of these bits and pieces. But as you actually drill down into the details, to the actual systems, and you say, well, hang on a sec, there's something seriously wrong here. So, the self-assessment that's going on here that people have used with even the figures, I'd say that there's probably a bit of, potentially dubious data going in there anyway.
You just described to me the ultimate reason why I think PCI DSS is useless, by the way. You can put everything in a ring binder, but that doesn't make it reality. You know what I mean?
No, it certainly doesn't. And this is something which has been really pushed very hard by the council to actually make sure that the QSAs that are doing the audits are going through and not only saying, okay, the policies are in place, people are doing this stuff, but actually verifying it on the systems.
The council, you make them sound so important. Do they wear silly little wigs like barristers and long silk robes?
I don't know, mate.
Now, I've got to ask too, did you find it surprising that Oracle was so... I mean, I wonder why Oracle was so happy to sort of part with this information and put it on the public domain that their customers don't patch. The only reason I can think of is they're trying to take the blame off themselves for the bad track record of Oracle products.
Look, I think there's probably a little bit of that. And I think the other thing is that they don't want their clients to feel bad about not patching. One of the questions that we often get asked is, well, okay, so, our security posture is, for want of a better word, crap. How do we rate to everyone else? Is everyone else crap as well?
Let's all wallow in the crap together.
Exactly. And
let's
so
all have
people
a crap
can look
fight.
At this report and go, you know what? Nobody else is patching either, so we're fine.
Yeah. Oh, God. So, I mean, look, how often, I hear horror stories. You guys do a lot of pen testing. But, I imagine that from what you're saying is once you're in past the perimeter defences, getting into an Oracle box doesn't sound like it's that much of a challenge for these sorts of reasons.
Not at all. Realistically, most internal networks are so soft and squidgy that once you get inside that perimeter, they could have their Oracle boxes fully patched and everything else, but there's going to be some silly legacy application that's accessing the data on the database without using any form of encryption across the LAN, and so just sniffing that, grabbing the passwords and just logging into it is, going to be the simplest way as ever.
So even if the database doesn't let you down, your application will?
Most likely.
That's fantastic news, mate. I can hear everyone popping the corks right now. So what do you do? I mean, what can you do when you've got the CEO? I mean, I know what you mean about, you've got 100 apps there, some of them are legacy apps. If you update, you might break stuff. Then that team gets angry. You get a call from the CEO. Even if it's just scheduled maintenance, you have to roll back. You're down for an extra 10 minutes than you were supposed to be. You get a call from the CEO. So I understand that the DBAs might be a little bit reticent to sacrifice uptime for the sake of security. But this is why I'm surprised security teams haven't almost moved in to protect database teams from management retribution and sort of educate management on why this is important.
Yeah, I think a lot of security teams have difficulty getting leverage within the organisation. It comes down to the age-old problem of, is security a roadblock or an enabler,
It's a roadblocker, let's just admit it. every single security company tries to convince their clients otherwise, but it is a roadblocker.
I can certainly understand how it seemed to be that way.
Okay, you can convince me next time we meet on why it's not.
Yes, yeah, certainly. Don't ever underestimate the power of an executive, right? An executive with a commitment. And we can sit here and we can talk about all the complexities, the applications, all the reasons why people can't be doing it properly. And you only need one high level in the executive in an organization to draw a line in the sand and say, this is now a priority. Here is your resources. Here are your budgets. Here are your deadlines. And then miraculously things just start to happen.
Now, surely what I wonder, though, is surely leaving your core database unpatched has got to be some sort of compliance problem somewhere.
Oh, absolutely.
So these guys are deliberately, knowingly breaching compliance guidelines and compliance mandates.
Yeah.
Yeah, someone called the compliance police dudes. We'll get the PCI council on them.
Yep.
I'll sick them. All right, Declan, thank you very much for joining us with your views.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Declan Ingram on the line from Sydney there in this week's feature interview. Now, we're sticking with the Oracle Patch survey story by talking now with Simon Howard about this issue. Now, Howie is best known, as I mentioned earlier, as the organiser of the Race 2-0 competition at DEF CON. But he's a man of many talents. He's had considerable experience working with enterprise systems and database administrators. And he says host security is another area severely lacking in many or most database deployments. Howie joins me now. Now, mate, first up, why do you think DBAs don't install these patches?
They typically task with maintaining their database and looking after it and keeping it running. And the other intricacies of keeping your kernel up to date and not having every service in the world listening on ports and having strong passwords, they generally don't take any of that stuff into consideration. And particularly, like a good example is just having no password on the SA account. The Unix passwords are going to be weak quite weak as well, generally.
You were going to say weak as piss then, weren't you? I've heard all the horror stories, too, about guys doing pen tests on Oracle boxes, and they get in because there's, you know, X11 listening with no authentication. I mean, is that stuff you've seen as well?
Yeah, well, I've seen, like, good DBAs, guys who I respect as a database administrator, and they're going to install a new 10G installation. And I say, well, you don't need an X server to install this. How about we tunnel it back to your desktop? Or is there any way to install Oracle 10G without an X component or without the GUI display? And the guy didn't know how to do it. He's like, not that I know how.
I mean, do you blame the DBAs for that, or do you blame Oracle for making their sort of package installation?
I blame Oracle for getting them into that habit in the earlier versions of using a GUI to install the product, and then they just think, oh, there can't be any text way to do it now. I'm just going to keep sticking to the GUI either by installing X on the server or X hosting it back to my desktop where I've got Cygwin and an X server running.
Now you've
which
had
opens up a whole bunch of other ports and security issues if they don't close them up after they've installed. They knew this stuff with keeping databases online and lots of old antiquated versions of databases online. But when it came to any security or patching, they just didn't want to know about it.
So how come the security team doesn't come down and, like, kick these guys' heads? I imagine that would have been your job.
Our job was to manage the servers for the DBAs, and all they did was manage the database on top of it. And so any change requests to get, say, X11 running or to open any ports back to their desktop to do some funky configuration thing, it would all come through change requests and we'd approve it. And then once they'd done the task, then we'd harden the machine again. We'd tighten up IP tables or uninstall the packages that they don't need anymore.
Yeah, you actually told me too when we were chatting online that you've seen guys actually just kill the entire firewall just so they could get X11 access instead of
turn off IP tables. Oh, this is stopping me from X hosting back or whatever. Okay, I don't want to learn IP tables, so I'm just going to turn it off. And then they'll often forget to turn it back on again.
Yeah, hooray. But, I mean, that seems an odd way to do things, doesn't it? That they have to ask you to basically de-harden the machine and then you have to re-harden it every time you want to make some sort of config change. Was it a system that worked reasonably well in your experience?
Yeah, it was. It just becomes part of their change control procedure. And once they get used to it and when they've got their scheduled maintenance or for the patches or whatnot, then they just include that component of notifying us, and after a while I'd even let them do the tasks required, and then they start to learn as well what's involved in hardening and softening the box to get the necessary components onto it.
Now, whose job was it to ensure that the database and the applications themselves were secure? Did that fall into the DBA
side?
Yeah,
that was the DBAs. To do, like, the Oracle quarterly patches that come out, that was their responsibility to install those if required. Often the patches would fix holes in modules that they didn't have installed, so they weren't necessary. But I just left it up to them. And now if it was, say, a remote root exploit on the Oracle listener, then I would make sure they patched it. But otherwise, if I didn't see it in the news or it wasn't known to me the implications of not installing the patch, then I'd just leave it up to them and trust their judgment.
And do you think reasonably that you could have actually trusted their judgment, Howie, or is this a case that you were just a bit too busy to deal with it?
Yeah, a bit too busy to deal with it. Yeah. Most of the Oracle patches that come out are SQL injection based, like privilege escalation or pop yourself a root shell due to some bug with an Oracle. They're not generally on the listening services. They're more in the modules installed in the SQL injection.
Yeah, but I mean, that means that obviously if the application allows it, then, you know, you're going to have a serious problem.
Yeah, that's right. The application that sits on top of the database and makes sure that's secure as well and free from SQL injection, etc.
So really, I mean, you would want almost another team looking after the application security at that point, wouldn't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Did you guys have that?
I'd often do some in-house or we'd outsource it to the likes of security assessment or lateral security or insomnia, any of those guys.
Do you think this is a problem that's just limited to Oracle, or do you think it's with any sort of specialist enterprise software that you're going to have these same sort of problems?
There's a lot of Oracle out there, so it's the problems brought to the forefront more than other software. But yeah, definitely you'll see the same kind of problems in other software. I think the X component definitely opens up a lot of holes, and with the other databases like MySQL or Postgres, just talking Unix databases here, they don't have as many issues because there's the application is as complex as Oracle for one, and they don't have all the other requirements of layering X on top to install bits and pieces.
Yeah, but I guess they don't really scale as well as Oracle, and they don't have all the bells and whistles, you know?
Yeah, that's correct.
Do you think one of the problems could be that this, you know, complicated enterprise software is just so fragile, so when you start messing around with patches and stuff, you're almost guaranteed to break some sort of legacy application?
Potentially. Because you are changing binaries within the database itself, there is a huge margin of error there. You could introduce performance problems, and even just taking the database down to apply the patch, the DBA is paid to keep the database online, so he doesn't really want to take it offline to do the patching, unless they're in a clustered environment where you can, or a dev lab environment where they can do the proper regression tests before upgrading the production host. It's very, very hard for them, I guess.
Now, you've been in this situation. You've worked with these guys. How would you set up a managerial structure so that you were confident you had all bases covered? I mean, who would you have doing what?
I'd have the system administrators looking after the hosts, the DBAs looking after the database, and the application programmers looking after the front-end application. But the system administrators still looking after those hosts as well. And a good segregated network with your databases on one host and your application hosting in another, files in between.
And would you rely on the DBAs to actually apply the appropriate patches to the database?
The security team should be keeping an eye on what patches are coming out, and then they'd have to liaise with the DBA. So quarterly they'll have a meeting to discuss the latest Oracle patch and if it's required, and then what procedure we're going to do to either install it in the environment to perform the regression tests and then move it on to production, or whether we'll wear the risks of not installing it, or if it's not even applicable at all.
So you'd have the sysadmins looking after the hosts, you'd have the app guys looking after the apps, the DBAs looking after the database, and the security guys watching absolutely everyone.
Yes.
Sounds like a bit of work. All right, Simon Howard, thank you very much for your time.
Cool, cheers.
Simon Howard on the line from New Zealand there, rounding out our feature on database security. In next week's feature slot, we'll be chatting with HD Moore about his latest fun project. It's called WarVox, and I'm sure it'll be making a bit of a splash in coming weeks. Tune in next week for more information on that one. But right now, it's time for this week's sponsor interview. Now, the reason our sponsors pay us is so they can come onto the show and have their two cents, say, speak their mind, basically. And this week, we've got Paul Ducklin from Sophos on the show talking about this recent spate of 0 days. And he joins me now to tell us what companies like Sophos are actually, what they can do as endpoint security providers to actually protect customers against these sorts of threats. Although he started off by giving us this mitigation for that PDF vulnerability that is everywhere at the moment.
There's a good mitigation. It doesn't fix the issue, but there's a very good mitigation for the Adobe exploit, which is to turn off Adobe's rendering of JavaScript. The exploit is, I suspect, pretty hard to trigger unless you have JavaScript turned on. It's not a bug in the JavaScript handler itself, but I would suggest that turning off JavaScript, which I don't think I've ever needed it when viewing a PDF file. Will mitigate quite strongly. And Adobe say they're going to have a fix out by the 11th of March. So turn off JavaScript till then apply the patch as soon as you hear that it's good to go.
Paul, from your perspective, you know, from a Sophos perspective, how do you deal with something like this? You hear of a zero day that's being exploited in the wild. I mean, customers are obviously going to expect you guys to deliver them some sort of protection, whether that's by rolling out a signature or relying on some sort of heuristic blocking, you know, feature in your products. I mean, what do you guys actually do when something like this is doing the rounds?
There are several different responses that we may or may not be able to give depending on the way that the vulnerability looks, how exploitable it is. So one of the things we can do, obviously, if there's an obvious flavor or a smell that we can get, say, to a file that is using a particular exploit, I'll try and think of an example off the top of my head. Remember that years ago, the JPEG exploit, right, which was regarded as quite catastrophic at the time because suddenly pictures were dangerous.
Yeah.
That hadn't really happened before. And we were able to write an identity for our products that whenever you were looking for viruses or threats in files, a JPEG file that contained a potential malformed object that could be an exploit would be blocked or could be blocked by our product. The problem is sometimes we can't, that when you try and do that with something that's not just detecting the exploit in a file, or if your product is one, not saying ours are, but if your product is one which, say, provides an automatic patch, temporary in-memory patch to a DLL, you do need to be careful that by providing that patch, you aren't giving an easily disassemblable instruction to people who don't know how the exploit works by giving away exactly, you know, which byte of code, which jump, which compare whatever, which buffer copy is actually the defective one, and sort of writing a training manual for people who otherwise wouldn't know how it worked.
Well, you were actually just talking about doing basically format checking on a JPEG to make sure it's all kosher and there's no, you know, nasty malformed objects in there. But shouldn't the operating system be doing that?
The operating system, perhaps, if that file format is key to the operating system itself. A good example of that would be the ELF format for Linux, the PE, executable format for Windows. You could argue that for formats which are normally not handled natively by the operating system, that it's the duty of each individual application. Of course, there's a middle ground, isn't there? There's the DLLs that many operating systems will provide to standardize access to certain sorts of object.
But I mean, that's sort of what I mean, is if you start writing your endpoint security software to do sanity checking on file formats and, you know, file construction, then really you're basically duplicating a lot of the work that should have been done in the OS that's been done badly, which is how come you've got the vulnerabilities. I mean, it just seems a bit ridiculous that endpoint security providers have been forced into this situation where they're having to basically rewrite components that should be in the OS or at least should ship with the OS.
I don't know whether I can sort of safely argue with that. I guess, you know, we're saving the world from the problems that other vendors didn't manage to fix. I mean, that's a cynical view. I think that if you relied on something like let's call it an antivirus product, just to avoid using all the things that antivirus software covers these days. If you rely on endpoint security products for doing the file format checking of absolutely every file format that you ever might use,
for example,
I agree,
PDF.
You're doing the wrong thing. On the other hand, if we can help when there's a clear and present danger, and we often can, then I don't see any problem with doing that as a belt and braces. But you're right, if that becomes the primary way of defending against these sorts of problem, then, yeah, we are doing something wrong. I'm not sure that that is the case. I think we're somewhere in between, where things like modern versions of what traditionally was an antivirus program can deal with quite a number of the threats as a kind of add-on way of protecting. And operating systems and applications, for all that we hear about more vulnerabilities and exploits these days, probably are getting safer, if only because vendors are being forced to have more scrutiny over how they code, what they code, and how rapidly they respond when they're found wanting.
Now, I take it you guys have issued some sort of signature that protects customers over the PDF thing?
The PDF one is tricky. I don't want to say too much so that I give away exactly how it works to people who otherwise wouldn't know. I think that your primary vehicle for dealing with that is going to be turning off JavaScript inside Adobe. The problem with recognizing this potential problem inside every PDF file that happens to pass your way, whether you're going to use it or not, and you can't know in advance, is that the overhead would be quite high, because it would involve analyzing more of the file than you typically would have to. It's my cautious answer of saying, in this case, I don't think that you can rely on antivirus products alone. You need to apply the mitigation in the Adobe product that's been described by Adobe, or, dare I say it, you could temporarily switch to using a different PDF reader, one which is, you know, less powerful and perhaps doesn't have all the features, which would hopefully leave out not only some of the features but also this particular bug.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, antivirus vendors or, you know, companies that provide endpoint security that were traditionally antivirus companies like Sophos, you know, have come under a bit of fire, particularly over the last couple of years, for what is seen as a diminishing effectiveness of their products in, you know, facing such a broad spectrum of threats. And, you know, this is probably a good example where you're saying, look, we couldn't really take care of this one, but we can advise for a mitigation. What is happening in terms of product development to combat these types of threats?
I keep hearing all these criticisms, antivirus is dead and it relies on, it's all reactive and it relies on signature scanning and blah, blah, blah. You know, you hear that from analysts, you hear it from the media, you hear it from prospective customers. Signature scanning became intractable or impracticable as the sole means of virus checking in about 1989 when the first polymorphic viruses came out, and that's why we gave up relying on it 20 years ago. So, you know, we have come on a little way since then. As we mentioned earlier, you can't expect the idea that an antivirus program, which is designed to detect a broad spectrum of threats, let's be honest, the idea that it should always be expected to analyze every single byte of every single file before it allows it to be used, and to carry around with it, you know, a huge amount of code to deal with possibly esoteric file formats, I think that's unreasonable. I think we do a very good job of detecting against obvious cyber criminal threats such as Trojans, banking Trojans, a wide range of exploits. Because let's face it, what normally happens is when you get one of these, let's say you get one of these infective PDFs, and through a circuitous route, which we have other means of blocking. For example, it relies on a buffer overflow, this particular exploit, and we already have generic technology which would prevent that from happening. So, in other words, we can block it on a well-informed user's computer that has been correctly configured without having to read through every byte of every file to the nth degree in order to provide the prevention. And in any case, the usual behavior when an exploit is triggered is to run some small amount of delivered shellcode which leads to the next part of the attack.
Which is to go out and grab the payload.
Exactly. And that payload might be embedded. By the way, in the Excel exploits, we've seen cases where it's possible to embed the payload inside the executable, but the shellcode has to spew it to disk. We see it arrive on disk. Now we've got another piece of malware with all the potential misbehaviors that have that we can block.
So basically what you're saying is, even though this thing might be able to do a couple of things, chances are, unless it's a mega, mega customized attack, you're going to catch it anyway if it's some sort of low level common garden or what do they call it? Garden or variety Trojan.
Well, of course I would say that, but I am saying it because I believe it to be true. If we rely on always exactly blocking every aspect of the attack at every point, then I think we're doing too much work for the payback we'll get. But if we can block, you know, if there are 7 points to every attack and 99.99% of the time we can get 4 of those 7, then we've pretty much won anyway, although technically you could say we're not getting 100%. You know, in the real world, we're delivering as close as we practically can to that amount.
Okay, well, Paul Duckland, thank you very much for your time this week.
It's a pleasure, Patrick.
Paul Duckland from Sophos there. And normally we'd go to our audio mailbag, but we have no voicemail feedback this week. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard on Risky Business, or indeed something you'd like to hear on Risky Business, you can call Sydney 02 8569 1835 or USA on 877 688 8417, and that's a toll-free number. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. See, the big picture is this. We take from their music, so don't take the piss out of me. For see, the problem is occurring. Australia's culture, this big pop is stirring. You get beautiful things from this huge racial mix. Don't take all from the one that inflicts the stereotype of what's great. Don't forget, bonds aren't your beauty and mate. But when it comes to the crunch, what is Australian culture? There's only one and it's not your fault. You're like me, born a white Australian male, whose history has a sad sorry tale of killing and destruction and violence and rape. And alcohol's a way to escape. But 40,000 beers went hard for 40,000 years. But 40,000 beers went hard 40,000 years.
What is Australian culture?
Talk about patching, and it's like, yeah, we're really secure. We patch everything, and then they're just not, you know.
So you're saying they're full of shit?
Oh, absolutely.